You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY, Portland at 91.1 and 107.1 FM, and in Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Radio is yours. What is success? What does it mean to be successful? Is it all about money? Or is it all about love, fame, attention? Or is it some secret other thing that we've yet to explore? I'm Brianna Wheeler, and I want to know what success means to the people that I think are successful. Because success can mean so many different things to so many different people. So let's discover a few new ways together. This is Success Stories. Hello, and welcome to Success Stories, a 30-minute radio program and accompanying podcast featuring Portlanders who have found success in unique and inspiring ways and have shifted Portland's economic, creative, and cultural landscape in the process. Success Stories is about the people who give, nurture, and help keep Portland's reputation as the coolest, nerdiest, weirdest, and most beautiful city in the nation fully intact. Today, we are talking to playwright extraordinaire, Mickey Gillette. Mickey, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Brianna. Thanks for asking me.
Absolutely. So Mickey is a playwright and a prolific playwright at that. I was first introduced to your work, writing a review about it for the Willamette Week. And I was stricken not just by the subject matter of what you were producing, but also the skillfulness with which you write dialogue, with which you create personal relationships and then bring them to life in such devastating detail. There's this implication that coming to see one of your shows that I'm going to get this education on trans lifestyles or trans community, but I have found consistently that all I'm seeing is like a mirror. Like 100%, it's a mirror into how regular all of these experiences can be. So I guess my first question is, where does it start? When do you realize that being a playwright is, I mean, it's kind of low-key your calling?
So I grew up in Eugene until I was 11. Then my family moved to LA and I went to UCLA. And at that time, like, everybody wanted to be a filmmaker. You know, everybody thought like we were going to be Quentin Tarantino or something. And so I thought I would probably write screenplays because I knew I liked dialogue and expressing myself that way. And then, so I wrote some not very good screenplays. And this is kind of embarrassing, but one day I went for a jog. And when I came back, I was like, if I had been hit by a car and died on that jog, I would not have left anything worthwhile.
Oh my gosh.
It's a very early 20s thought, I think.
Totally.
And that made me, I was an English major. And so I was like, well, I want to write like the stuff that I really liked. And so I started studying. I stopped writing and just started reading over and over the things that I liked, trying to kind of take them apart, figure out what made them good, see how I could get in there and do that kind of writing. And the more I did that, the less it seemed like trying to make that happen in film would be possible, just seeing the experiences my friends were having in that industry. And I really loved theater, so I thought, well, that's probably an avenue that's more inviting to personal expression. So it was in my early 20s, before I ever transitioned, that I really kind of made that path or sought that path for myself.
You said that you were kind of affected by watching your friends' experiences. What were they experiencing?
A lot of heartbreak, a lot of people saying, oh, I really like this, we can make this happen. And then you have this whole vision of a life for yourself, and then it just kind of goes away because not everybody keeps their word.
In Hollywood?
I know. And then just seeing people compromise or start to internalize the idea that compromise is very necessary. And I think because the financial rewards are so big, the people are like, well, that's worth it. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I've not ever been the person who's like driven by that as much as by what I want to do.
Yes. So
I've kind of looked for the path where I can do what I want to do and try to find people who want to do that with me, as opposed to trying to monetize whatever I'm doing to the greatest degree.
Literally goals. That is the inspo for the show, really.
Wow.
This is kind of like the big question, because I think when, you know, the layman is seeking success, they're thinking in their head that that's what they need to do. They need to find that place. They need to find that niche and fill it. Tell me about the blueprint, the road that you took to get from, this is what I thought I want. This is what I actually want.
Oh, that's a good question. So yeah, I think it was really intuitive. I think like I had this one dream that was like, I'm going to be on the cover of the magazines. Like I'm going to be at the festivals, all of that stuff. And then maybe it was just taking that period of being like, you know, I'm going to go off by myself for a while and try to figure this out. And when I came back from that, like that dream stopped being the dream. Mm-hmm. Like in my head, I'll still fantasize like Todd Haynes is going to walk into my play and be like, this needs to be my next movie or something.
Could happen.
And Todd Haynes, if you're listening, please do that.
Drop into the chat. Todd, right. Drop into the chat.
But yeah, when it came out, it was like, no, this is, and then the weird thing is when I started doing the plays, I was still kind of had those dreams of like, you know, there are theater festivals, there are bigger stages than the ones that I do, that my plays get produced on, and be like, oh, that would be cool to do that. But once you're doing it, it's really the relationships with the people that mean the most, like the actors, the directors, the stage managers, like you're all in this together.
Yeah.
And it becomes this temporary family. And when that's happening, it feels kind of silly to be big-headed. I mean, I still, you know, I would still love for my stuff to get a bigger audience or, you know, get taught in schools, that kind of stuff. But that's not like driving my day-to-day life.
So you've just noted like how impactful that like forming that team can be, or when those people do come into your cipher and when you start to create with them.
Yeah.
What were there certain moves that you made that attracted these teams of people? Because I've seen the, what do we call it? The companies that put on your shows, and I've seen kind of the backstage. I've seen the dress rehearsals, and what a huge takeaway always is how everyone works so well together, and there seems to be this there's not really like a captain of the ship, but everyone is kind of in control in this way that speaks to like the how well everything is running and how everything kind of comes out in the wash too.
Do they
just come to you? Are you just giving off that vibe so fiercely that they are attracted to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think once everybody's together, like the director's kind of the person who's setting the tone the most, which isn't me. I don't really know how to direct, but I found in Portland that there is a real, nothing is very top down. Like, mm-hmm. It's not like you need to do this like authoritarian in any way. It's very collaborative. I do think there's something about having majority trans casts where there just aren't that many majority trans spaces. And so when everybody's together, there's kind of a sense of like safety and maybe a sense of purpose, and people want something to succeed. I've never had that conversation with people, but that's kind of a sense that I've gotten. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're pretty lucky, the folks we got. The first couple of plays, we were really beating the bushes because trans people just didn't respond to audition notices that much because, you know, maybe they'd had bad experiences or they didn't think the plays were for them. So I was going into Facebook groups, you know, sharing the audition notice, asking friends if they knew someone who could, you know, meet this character description. And so those were kind of non-traditional theater groups that were brought together. Mm-hmm. And some of those people had carried over from production to production, but now there's also like students in college who see the audition notice and want to come, and that's fun. I think there is something kind of, kind of special about people who are there because they want to be. Like, nobody's making their living off these plays. Yeah. So it's a very opt-in experience, and that kind of creates a nice vibe, I think.
Yeah. There is the energy is that water finds its own level. You know, everybody's just boom on the same page. Have you seen, so you've been in the game for a minute, and then so it was, while it was trickier for you to find casts early on,
yeah,
like how has that tide changed from then to 2026? I mean, is it, you're saying, like, just the general feeling, the conversation around trans identities has changed. Oh my God, let me start over again. The general feeling about trans identities and how they're politicized, and how much more, especially in Portland, how encouraged it is to find your identity and live your truth. So is it like, are people climbing over each other to be part of your plays now? Because it does really seem like you are, whether you planned it this way or not, like kind of a definitive voice of the trans experience in Portland, maybe even nationally too, because you are like an award-winning playwright. I mean, your stuff gets played, you know, you're popular, you're kind of famous. So are people really like, oh, are the cast lists getting bigger? The audition lists getting longer?
Not so much. I know. And I don't know why, because I think there is a bigger pool, but they, you know, people get busy doing other things. You know, maybe they need to spend some time making money, or maybe they got cast in a musical and that's their favorite thing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've never not been able to fill a cast, which is great. And it's always nice to work with new people, but I don't think we've had situations where it was like three people for every part.
Right.
For whatever reason. And then, yeah, I do remember. So when we did Magnetic Electric, which is that musical that you came and saw.
Gorgeous, gorgeous. Loved it. Cannot say enough good things about that musical. Bring it back.
Oh, thanks. I remember maybe it was the night before opening, Ruby Welch, who was the director, gave a speech to the cast and was talking about how a friend of hers was doing this, some other show at another theater. I don't want to throw shade.
Do.
And she was like, I'm happy for that person, but in this political moment, doing anything other than this show would feel a little empty to me.
Right.
And I think, you know, we don't talk about it a lot, but when the plays are political, I think it does have this like sense of meaning that's kind of powerful for us.
Yeah. I would assume that your plays, just by the nature of you being a trans playwright, would inherently be political just because of where you're coming from, point blank, period. And so Magnetic Electric, for the uninitiated, is not necessarily like, it's a diegetic musical?
Yeah, diegetic, yeah.
Diegetic musical. So the music just existed in the play. It exists in a bar where there's a musical act, which is also the owner of the bar, this amazing singer who really just fills the room with the most, oh my gosh, just heart-stopping voice. So it has like a gorgeous soundtrack, but there is this overarching theme that the trans identities are under attack, trans individuals are under attack, this play isn't necessarily historically based. However, a lot of your plays are. And I want to ask, do you feel that deep impetus to tell those stories? Because you really are like inking the history book on this. Like you are writing, you're making those narratives available for people that would otherwise not have access to these stories. Yeah. And it feels, I don't know, it feels like there's a balance between the stories that you tell that are personal, that are just kind of play like a romantic dramedy kind of moment. But then there's also like historical plays, Candy Darling,
Blonde on a Bum Trip,
telling a story from a different perspective. So when you're thinking about the production, are you juggling between, okay, well, I need to tell this story. I need to tell the story of the Compton cafeteria riots, but I also want to tell a story about a college thruple that goes wrong. Are you tossing coins to figure out what's next, or is it just coming from that deep well of creativity inside?
Yeah, it's the latter. I mean, I wish there were more stories to tell from history. It kind of, for my imagination, for whatever reason, it kind of takes a certain amount of source material to feel like there's a whole play. And so with the Warhol scene, with Candy Darling, Hollywood Lawn, and Jackie Curtis, like there was a lot of source material. There were the movies they made, right. There were their memoirs. With Compton's, there was that really great documentary, and then all of the like oral histories the historian had done. Mm-hmm. And so those were moments where I felt like, oh, I can really get in here and tell this story. And that was exciting. But there just aren't that many moments that are documented like that, right. Unfortunately. And then for something like Mimetic Desire, which is the college relationships gone bad.
Loved that too. That,
those are like drawing on personal history. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why they're less political, because those were taken from a time before I had transitioned, so politics weren't as front of mind, and all of the shenanigans people were getting up to was was what was inspiring them.
Right. So how gnarly was that pivot, pre-transition and post-transition in your work?
Oh, okay. So that's kind of the defining moment, because there were times when I tried to write and it, I was really perfectionistic, and I think that was because I was afraid to share stuff. And then gender stuff would just kind of make its way into the work in a way that probably made me even more reluctant to share it, because I didn't really understand it and I didn't know what people would think of it. So I kind of never really got my stuff out there before I transitioned. And then it was like, I was just writing every day. I was wanting to share it however I could. So that was kind of this before and after moment for me.
In your inner eye, in your third eye, go deep. I look at you and I think, well, damn, that's a successful playwright. If we remove like those kind of, the markers of like success that we kind of were taught to acknowledge as success. If I look beyond that and I think of someone who is really living their creative purpose, I see you as undoubtedly one of the peak success stories of the city. But that's just my point of view. That's just my point of view. I want to know, in your heart, in your brain, when you think about the most successful version of Mickey Gillette, playwright or not, what does that, who is she? What does she look like?
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. I mean, for a while I thought like, oh, I really want my work to be shared at places like Portland Center Stage, mm-hmm. but in different cities around the country. And like now, and I have this conversation with other theater artists, like it feels like that level of theater is kind of crumbling, mm-hmm. like the funding that they can get, the type of work that they can do is not, it just doesn't seem hospitable to someplace that's doing my kind of stuff. publishing is a goal of mine. Like, at some point I'd really like to publish the plays, maybe because that's how I encountered plays, and it's like, oh. But yeah, I feel really lucky. Like, the other day I was taking a walk and I was like, wow, it's kind of crazy that there's a few companies in town who every year are open to doing one of my plays, and they're never like, well, Riot Queens was a hit, so we need another one like that, or something. Like, it's, you know, I'm just kind of following my muse and getting to write the things that inspire me, mm-hmm. and then getting to share them. That is a real gift. So, yeah, I mean, I can still daydream about, you know, like, what if the New Yorker profiled me? You know, these things that just seem like these big markers of success for people in the arts. You know, I wouldn't mind that. But right now I feel like things are going really well and it's exciting.
I love that. Okay, tell me this. New York calls tomorrow, or LA, Hollywood calls tomorrow. We've got the gig for you. We've got the gig. We need you here for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years.
Oh.
You leaving? Are you staying in Portland with the companies that have been supporting you all of these years?
What's the gig?
It's your dream gig. It's somebody wants to put on, they want to make Riot Queens into a Hulu limited series or something to that effect. All transcast. They're putting you executive producer role, so you can just play puppet master and you don't have to direct, because I don't know, you don't like that.
Oh my gosh, that is so unimaginable. Like, now that, who's the Ellison guy who owns all of entertainment now?
Oh, right. Okay, let's say Dropout. Dropout TV is a very ethical production company.
I would think about it. I mean, I would definitely come back to Portland when I was done, but that's a way, I think. It's pretty common for artists to want to reach the biggest audience they can. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody, but that seems interesting. I mean, I would definitely sleep on it. But it, like, the way you presented it sounds good.
We're dreaming big out here. Yeah. I love that you just said something very impactful, and I think that it bears repeating, that there's something about reaching the biggest possible audience that you can directly correlate to, like, an idea of success, especially in this medium, because the more people that learn this history, the more people that interact with this content, the better, because then we learn how our differences are not. They really are not. We are out here wanting and hoping and loving the same ways, wanting to be loved and accepted and celebrated in all the same ways. Which is such a, like, marker of a Mickey Gillette play, is that a person who's maybe has never met a trans person, has no trans friends, might go in there thinking, oh, I don't know if I should even be here, and would immediately be like, oh, no, I am at exactly the right place. I am at exactly the right time, and I am learning, and I am loving. And there's the drama is always so good in these plays. I'm telling you, audience, if you get the chance, you have got to get into the theater to see the Mickey Gillette plays, which leads me to my last question. What is on deck for the rest of 2026?
Oh, okay. So there's another one with songs. Yeah. It's coming up in August. It's called The Dark Stuff. And Twilight Theater is producing it.
Gorge.
It's about this student who's like a trans woman, like 20. And then she has this professor who's 50 and a cis guy and not the most appropriate person. And they're studying poems, and so the poems are the songs, which is kind of cool.
Love. Also, note, audience, Mickey wrote the lyrics to all of the songs in Magnetic Electric, which I was just screaming about a couple of minutes ago, one of my favorite plays of 2025. And I gotta say, you've also kind of broke down a certain wall for me in the way that I interpret art, especially this medium, because I look at you as a playwright, and that is just that's what she does. She is a playwright. And it wasn't like, I wasn't able to blur the line. Like, a writer is a writer, Brianna. A writer is a writer. Like, of course you would write brilliant song lyrics. Of course you're going to be an amazing poet. Like, of course, duh. Do you get, like, how is it super, super fulfilling to also be able to, like, lean into those mediums, also poetry, lyrics?
Yeah, it really is. Like, when I was young, before I was dreaming of being a playwright, I was dreaming of being a rock star, even though I'm,
of course,
like an introvert who can't sing and or hear pitch. I would write lyrics to the songs that I thought I would be singing.
Love.
So to be able to, like, kind of tap into that and express the characters through that kind of writing is it's really fun and exciting. And then Ash is the composer I work with, and they write such amazing melodies. So then I'll have these songs stuck in my head, and I'll be like, oh my God, I wrote those lyrics. How did that happen?
Oh my, I love that you surprise yourself. Do you not know you're a genius? Do I need to tell you? Mickey, you are a genius.
Can you follow me around all the time? No one's complimenting me this way but you.
Thankfully, this does come out as a podcast, so you can just download that and just listen to it at your leisure whenever
you
need it.
Yeah, that can be my pump-up music when I'm going into a rehearsal.
Hell yeah. Don't you ever forget that you are a Portland success story. Thank you so much for your time today, Mickey. I've really loved chatting with you, and I think that the listeners are going to really appreciate this conversation as well.
It was a pleasure. I can't wait to listen back.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining me for another episode of Success Stories. See you next time. And remember, success is what you make it.